The XTC Podcast.
What do you call that noise?
What do you call that noise?
Do you know what noise awakes you every morning from your bed? Well, it could be the sound of the reissued 200-gram vinyl edition of Mama dropping through your letterbox. Welcome to What Do You Call That Noise? The XTC Podcast. And in this episode, we are reassessing XTC's most frequently neglected album in the company of some of its biggest fans. My name is Mark Fisher, and we'll be talking about Mama in just a few minutes, but not until we have heard this month's musical contribution. Regular listeners will remember that Ed Stainsby got the ball rolling a few months ago with Climbing Frame, a song inspired by a conversation on the podcast about playgrounds in XTC songs.
I've been thinking all day about the climbing frame. I've been playing by the rules, but it's not.
The following month, David White came up with Still Got It, which was inspired by the podcast discussion of English Settlement, and in particular No Thugs in Our House.
I leave my hedge uncut, and I don't care. I let my toffee nosy neighbours stare.
Then last month, Gary Perkins got right to the point with What Do You Call That Noise?
What do you call that noise? My dad is shouting, turn it off. The neighbours rang to say they've not seen enough. I've got my music up loud.
This month, it is the turn of Chris Badley, who joins us now to tell us about Round and Around.
What do you call that noise?
Hi, I'm Chris Badley, vocalist and lyric writer with the band Foolish Men. And we created the track Round and Around, taking inspiration from the English Settlement, The Expert's View podcast. So just a bit of preamble. In my working life, I used to get the train from Bristol to London quite often. And being an XTC fan, paid particular attention to when the train went through Swindon and the surrounding countryside, wondering how a band like XTC could come from such a place. Those feelings lay pretty dormant until I listened to the podcast, and two or three things sort of resonated and formed the ingredients for our track. Firstly, the birth of Swindon as a railway town, as referred to in the Ball and Chain segment, the juxtaposition between this rural community servicing the demands of modern commuter life, resulting in the house from the song eventually being knocked down. Then, in the section about senses working overtime, the chap who lives with synesthesia talks about extreme contrasts and accepting the good with the bad. The contrast, again, for me, in this case, being the farmer looking on in bewilderment as a London train runs through his field every day of the week. And then finally, the lady who discusses English roundabout and sees the song as about commuting and wanting to get off the endless metaphorical roundabout, the rut if you like, but not being able to do so. So in our song, there's a long-suffering farmer looking on at the downtrodden commuters on the trains and vice versa. And the contrast between the two, both wishing they could swap places to escape their respective daily grind. And around it goes. The final conceit of the song was trying to create a track that musically and thematically could fit in with the more pastoral direction of English Settlement, daring to imagine how David Gregory and Hugh Padgham might have reacted to this XTC track that never was on the following podcast. In our wildest dreams, of course. That's it. Round and Around by Foolish Men. Hope you like it.
The farmer's fate is sealed, praying for a better yield. He ploughs the barren fields and that's how it goes. And the bosses in their offices prepare their spreadsheet prophecies to keep the workers from grindstone to nose. And round it goes, reaping what we sow. And round it goes, cause that's all we know. It goes, going with the flow. And round it goes, and round it goes. And through the farmer's field, cuts the railway track, taking commuters to work and back. And the farmers and the workers look on with curious faces, hating their jobs, wishing they could just swap places. And round it goes, reaping what we sow. And round it goes, cause that's all we know. And round it goes, going with the flow. And round it goes, and round it goes.
Has got the grass is greener on the other side. That's how it is when town and country collide.
And round it goes, reaping what we sow. And round it goes, cause that's all we know. And round it goes, going with the flow. One works from 9 to 5, the other works from 5 to 9. What's yours is yours, and mine is mine. It's no different in a trap place, open space or rat race. The killer or the briefcase, chained to the workplace. The farmer so agreed, praying for a better yield. He searched from field to field, and that's how it goes. On the train, sitting pretty, workers from a big city, wallowing in self-pity, neatly in rows. And round it goes, reaping what we sow. And round it goes, cause that's all we know. And round it goes, reaping what we sow. And round it goes, and round it. And round it goes, reaping what we sow. And round it goes, cause that's all we know. And round it goes, going with the flow. And round it goes,
What do you call that noise?
That was Chris Badley and Dave Marson, who go by the name of Foolish Men. And you can find Round and Around in full by searching for Foolish Men on Spotify. If you are a songwriter and you have been inspired by something we have discussed on What Do You Call That Noise, the XDC podcast, please send your song to mark@xdclimelight.com. Can't wait to hear what you come up with. As ever, many thanks to the Pink Things, Humble Daisies, and Knights in Shining Karma, whose support makes this podcast possible. To join them, all you have to do is go to patreon.com/Mark Fisher and choose your level of support. I'll be giving a shout out to the Knights in Shining Karma at the end of this episode. And if you haven't done so already, you should pop over to xdclimelight.com, where you'll be able to buy a copy of What Do You Call That Noise, an XDC Discovery book. There's also lots of other stuff to read and listen to on that website.
What do you call that noise?
This episode of What Do You Call That Noise, the XDC podcast, is neatly timed to coincide with the re-release of Mumma, the 11th in a series of XDC classics to be issued on 200-gram vinyl. With its original but never-used sleeve art restored, the album has been mastered by Jason Mitchell at Loud Mastering with input from Andy Partridge. Joining me today are three dedicated mummeristas. I don't know if that should be mummeradores. Mummeristas, I'll go for the moment, who I'm delighted to introduce now. We'll start with Crawford Blair. who was briefly a member of the XTC cover band Ecstatic. He's laughing at the thought of that. I don't think he ever actually got on stage with them.
No, I was like the Pete Best of Ecstatic, I think. Maybe. Or maybe not. Maybe even the bass player who died. Maybe I was that guy. I don't know.
we'll investigate that slowly, I think, and works as a freelance sound engineer, mixer and designer, including work on many a podcast. So if this episode isn't immaculately recorded, he'll be the first on the phone to tell me about it. So hello, Crawford.
Hi.
Next, we have Sean McGee, who is a singer, songwriter, programmer, MD, producer and mixer with several million record sales to his name. Sean has worked with Alison Moyet, Robin, Imogen Heap, Alanis Morissette, Sugar Babes, Rizzle Kicks and Britney Spears. And in What Do You Call That Noise? An XTC Discovery book, Sean described Mama to be his favourite XTC album, saying it was perfectly constructed. Hello, Sean.
Hello there.
Great to have you on. And then we have yet another musician as we welcome Tim Bonus, who has 7 solo albums to his name, including his latest, Butterfly Mind, which comes out in July. And his website describes the album as a thrilling fusion of art, rock invention, post-punk energy and epic soulful ballads. So we're definitely in good company there. And Tim is also the co-host of the excellent podcast The Album Years with Stephen Wilson, a previous guest on this podcast. And he is also the co-founder of Burning Shed, the online record shop, so he has an extra reason for everyone to buy the new version of Mama.
hello, Tim. That is very true. Hello, yeah, because we host the official XTC and Andy Partridge stores, so yeah, please come to burningshed.com. And of course, I've been in a band with Stephen Wilson for many, many years as well, called No Man. That was the other thing.
And Stephen's engineered your new album, hasn't he?
He has, yeah. I mean, we still work together, obviously, you know, on a fairly regular basis, and obviously do the album years as well.
It's fantastic. So all the more reason for this to sound as perfect as it possibly could, much as Mama sounds as perfectly as it possibly could. I think I'll start with you, Crawford, because we've been having the longest conversation about Mama for quite a while. I know that you're a huge fan of the album, and it is just an album among the XTC catalogue. It's the one that people tend to forget, I think. I mean, some people are sort of vehemently anti-go-to or something like that, and are sort of mad, passionate Skylarking fans, for example. Mama tends to slip beneath the radar, but I personally have always had a very big soft spot for it. And is that the same for you?
Yeah, me too. I've always felt like I've had to defend its reputation. I think it's sort of gained a ill-gotten reputation as being a bit of a weak sister. And whereas obviously we can't, it's not for anyone to say what's the best album, what's the worst album. It's obviously entirely subjective. I think now that we have the privilege of being able to zoom out and look at XTC's catalogue, like as a sort of a from end to end, as a sort of episodic thing, it's easy to look at it in sections. And I feel like, you know, from English Settlement casts quite a long shadow. The highs are very high in English Settlement. It's an incredible record. Arguments about its double length aside. And then Mama and Big Express sort of are still in its shadow in a certain way. And also, Mama's quite an interesting record from the point of view of where the band were at the time, but how it was, this is like the beginning of their second act, if you like. You know, this is a very difficult period for them. You could make an analogue to the Beatles, you know, giving up touring and then going off, but the Beatles went immediately in and made, you know, Strawberry Fields. And whereas XTC had this very difficult, probably kind of fairly traumatic and an uncertain period of time. And I feel like some of that sort of rubs off on Mama. It's just because the album, it's sort of between the highs of English Settlement and the highs of Skylarking, and there's this little valley with 2 records in it. And I've always, you know, felt the need to kind of defend Big Express to a certain extent as well, but I'm more of a fan of Mama. I feel like I know in my heart it's not their best record, but it is my favourite record. Yes.
Is that how you feel, Sean? Because that balance between favourite and best.
Well, no, I'm a bit more arrogant about it, because my 2 favourite XTC records are Apple Venus Volume 1 and Mama. And the reason I like Mama more is that it doesn't have something like Fruit Nut on it, which makes me run across the room to hit skip. You can argue that there are better XTC songs on other albums, but I just feel like as a piece from start to finish, it's the right tracks in the right order. It all feels, it's just like a perfect whole. It feels of a piece across the whole album. It has a real mood and feeling about it. And it just, it fits together perfectly. And that's what an album should be, really. And there's a lot of the later XTC records where, you know, I honestly wish they were six tracks shorter. You know, I think that if the Apple Venus as a double album thing would have come to pass, it would have been like really, really, really bad. I'm really glad it was split into two records, because you can mostly then just take Wasp Star and put it away at the very back and only ever listen to The Wheel and the Maypole. You know, I think that the CD age actually did them some disservice because there was a thing of like, we must fill up the space available. You know, Skylarking's too long. Oranges and Lemons is way too long. Nonesuch is way, way too long. Mama is 10 tracks. It's two sides of vinyl. It's in, it's out. It says exactly what it wants to say, and then it's finished. It's great.
Well, I agree with lots of things you were saying there, including that sense that every single song, I don't have a song that I dislike on it. You know, so I was just playing it again the other day, and I was, even as I was listening to one song, I was looking at the track listing of the songs to come and thinking, oh, I'm really looking forward to this. I agree as well that there may be individual songs elsewhere in the catalogue that are fantastic, maybe more fantastic than any one on this one, but they're all really, really consistent. Tim, is this chiming with you?
Yeah, I mean, completely. I mean, I think it's interesting as well that Sean was saying that his other favourite is Apple Venus Volume 1, because my three favourites probably are Mama, Skylarking and Apple Venus Volume 1. And I like some of the early albums a lot, but I think there's kind of more sensitivity and more colour in these albums, really. And I guess it's partly to do with sensibility and taste as well, you know, what we bring to these records. So, you know, I'm a lot less keen on Wasp Star, for example. And I completely agree with Sean about the length of albums. I mean, it's something that we've discussed on the album years and something I've always done with my own albums, that, you know, I only create albums that are 36 to 44 minutes long, because I think that for certain types of music, both the audience concentration and the artist concentration works perfectly in that format. You know, I know it was an artificial construct, the LP in the 50s, but from the point of Sinatra and Billie Holiday making concept albums onwards, it's been the perfect statement for music for me, or the perfect format for a great statement for music for me. And I did feel that English Settlement was a little colourless in its production and a little overlong, as brilliant as it is. And after that, it's what everybody, you know, what most bands fell into, you know, listen to The Cure's Disintegration, that I've got 70, 80 minutes, and you know what, I'm going to fill 70, 80 minutes. And there's no sense of discipline. It's almost like the arc. And we had this pressure, you know, because I was first signed in the early 90s, and there was a lot of pressure to make long albums, to fill that space because it was there. And I think the CD age did a great disservice to the art of music.
Especially when CDs went from, they suddenly got longer as well. They expanded from 650 meg to 700 meg or something. You could get like, you know, this is like 79 minutes of audio on them all of a sudden. And everyone was like, oh, brilliant. But then, yeah, it was kind of like the folly of 90s music, like you say, in a lot of ways.
And it infected everything. I mean, I was a big fan of R&B in the 90s, and there were so many brilliant R&B records by TLC, by Missy Elliott, people like that, where there's a great 10-track album hiding inside a 19-track plus skits plus features album.
Yeah.
Remix for the European market. And it's like, I love you, Missy, but I don't have all day. You know, I've got to do the washing up, and, you know, I've got some work to do, and I can't be spending, you know, 80 minutes of my time. And it's like Crawford said, they were 72 minutes, and then they were 76, then 78, then 80. And it's like, no, that's too long. In the same way that films generally, I know things find the length they're meant to be. It shouldn't be a hard and fast rule. But if you see a film that's like 300 minutes long versus, you know, 120 minutes or 90 minutes or 100 minutes, then you're probably going to go for the shorter film. You know, I mean, I'm biased because I made myself sit through all of Heaven's Gate once.
I've seen that as well. There was an intermission, luckily, in the cinema. You know.
I took an intermission because I watched it at home. I think he should be lucky. I came back after the intermission because it's the most it's the most beautiful looking film. One of the most beautiful looking films I've ever seen, with absolutely zero at the heart of it. But but I'm getting off script here, which is but none of that is
No. Although again, weirdly, I know what you mean, because I always kind of thought at the time it was almost like you take a simple Eagles ballad with some nice imagery and you expand it into an opera. There was something about it where it almost kind of took its theme too far with Heaven's Gate, I felt, when I saw it.
That, you know? Like an Eagles song for me is already the idea of hell. It's this music they play on the elevator into hell.
So imagine Hotel California, the opera. Yeah.
My God.
I bet it's been discussed. I bet that has been mooted by somebody somewhere. I'm like, hey.
If they thought there was like 5 cents in it, they would have already done it. Because they will literally turn up for the opening of a door if the check is big enough.
So English Settlement is like the longest record, I presume, right? But it is a double. So what's the longest single? Would that be Oranges and Lemons, do you reckon? Or Nonesuch, perhaps?
Well, surely Oranges and Lemons was a double vinyl when it came out, because it's 65 minutes or something. I mean, there is precedent for major labels squeezing things like Jordan the Comeback by Prefab Frere onto one vinyl LP, even though it's 65, 70 minutes. 3 Feet High and Rising by De La Soul is another. But in form, it's definitely a double.
This might have been a conversation I had with you before, Sean, because my memory was that Nonesuch was a single album, but then I went to check it appeared to be in two, but I think it might have existed on, maybe it was a single CD and a double vinyl album, but I don't think of Nonesuch as a double, even though technically it is.
No.
I mean, it's so long. It's, what, 17 tracks?
It should be if it's not, yeah.
Or something like that. It's long. So there's absolutely no way that it would fit comfortably on two sides of regular vinyl without sounding absolutely terrible. So again, even if it was put out as a single vinyl for the small amount of people still buying vinyl in that era, like in form, it is really a double.
And I should say actually, for younger listeners, we are all talking about vinyl here in terms of Mama, and if many people have grown up with the CD versions of many an XTC album, which have got things like Toys and Desert Island sandwiched in between them, which to me...
Yeah, I wanted to talk about that, because that's insane. That was my first experience of Mama. It was the second XTC record I heard, and my friend handed me a CD of it one day that his dad had given him, and I think his dad had gotten it from like a CD club and didn't like it. And he handed me the CD, which was a little bit beaten up still. And I listened to it and didn't get on with it right away, like I think most people do with Mama. But then I noticed that it had 6 tracks just wedged in the middle, like a hole in a donut. And I was just wondering, and I know that, so those CDs, I went on Discogs to look, because they did the same with Black Sea, and they did the same with Big Express. They might have done it with white. They did it with white music, but I'm not sure if they did it in the middle with white music. I can't quite recall. But I went back and looked at this. So this is when the CDs were first issued in 1987. So somebody somewhere at Virgin, I don't know what they were thinking, but suddenly they saw fit to like programmatically just shoehorn Procession Towards Learning Land in the middle of the record. And so I hear the record, I still hear the record with that. When Deliverers, from the Elements, it all ends, I start hearing Frost Circus coming in.
So
and actually,
these are the 6 tracks that are the bonus versions on the subsequent Virgin EMI remaster. Yeah, they're in the middle of the album.
It goes, wow. It stops at like Deliverers from the Elements, and then it goes like Jump, Toys, Gold. No, Frost Circus, Jump, Toys, Gold, Procession Towards Learning Land, Desert Island. And then it comes back in with whatever the next track is, Human Alchemy or something like that. I mean, it's fucking insane. It's the same with Big Express has got, but actually Big Express is kind of quite nice because the songs, there's something about, like there's Red Brick Dream, which is one of my favourite XTC songs, so I'm quite happy to have that on Big Express by proxy. It's maddening. And I think with Black Sea, it's got things like Chain of Command and Limelight, or maybe is it Chain of Command, a Somnambulist and something else? Like kind of shoehorned in there.
That'd be Drums and Wires, though, wouldn't it? But
was that Drums and Wires?
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. Then? But Crawford, I'm intrigued by what you said, because you said that this, your first encounter was the album with all these songs in the middle, and still you think it's absurd. So even then, it sounded too wrong to you, did it?
I mean, it was great to get given a CD, and also great to have it 6 extra tunes on it. But because of Mike's, you know, listening to it, and I was probably, I guess I was maybe about 16, 17 at the time. I had known XTC from like the songs on the radio when I was growing up, and I bought, just before I got the CD bummer, I bought a vinyl copy of Waxworks. And I was delighted by the fact that I knew many more of the songs than I realized, which is quite common, I think, with when you buy someone's greatest hits, you know, you're like, oh yeah, I remember that. But Mama was my first sort of experience. And yeah, it's still embedded in my head, and Big Express to a certain extent as well with those. So when I listen to it on another medium, I'm always hearing Frost Circus coming in after, which actually I think would be a really nice little palate cleanser between Deliver Us from the Elements and Human Alchemy. I think there's a case to be made for its inclusion there.
Mm-hmm. And it is a reminder of just how prolific XTC were, because there's nothing wrong with any of those songs that you've just mentioned. In fact, many of them are fantastic.
They're great. I'm not so keen on Desert Island personally, but the rest are fantastic. And Procession Towards Learning Land is more of a mood piece than anything, mm-hmm. really. And it's a little bit scary, actually. I kind of find that quite disconcerting, that tune. But they all fit. I mean, I remember Stephen saying on the Album News pod about how much he enjoyed, he enjoys the B-sides of Mama, and how much, you know, it would be nice if he could finally get his hands on them and remix them.
Mm. Yeah.
Well, it's funny with XTC, myself and Stephen, we always have kind of swaps when we meet up, you know, CDs, vinyl, you name it. And one of the biggest ones we had when we first started working together, and I had this VHS of XTC documentary on Channel 4 with a Miles Davis concert. And it was interesting. This came under our very juicy category. and this meant that I ended up with several CDs for this VHS, which he still has. But it was one of the fiercest swaps we've ever had, really, XTC. And it's funny for me because I discovered the band, weirdly enough, on Magpie. And I don't know, are there any of you remember Magpie?
Yeah,
it was the ITV, raw and unruly companion, you know, sort of enemy of Blue Peter. And they used to have all sorts of music articles. So they had Godly and Cream with the Gizmotron, which was amazing, you know, an article on this. And they had XTC with, I think, Statue of Liberty. And that was the first time I ever heard them as a kid and absolutely loved it. But I think the first album I could afford was probably Black Sea. So that was kind of when I came in as a purchaser, really. But yeah, it was interesting as well, because I'd started reading the music papers around the early 80s. And I think what is English Settlement, Black Sea, Drums and Wires were revered by the journalists. And Mama and Big Express in particular, it almost appears to be some kind of slump. I think the new pop's taken over with NME. And they seem to be slightly neglected for some reason. So it kind of comes into a climate that's not as conducive to XTC. Although, as I say, you know, when I bought it, I absolutely adored it, particularly, you know, Love and the Farm Boy's Wages, which is arguably my favourite XTC song of all time.
I mean, it's interesting you mentioned the new pop there, because I listened to the album again today and made some notes just while I was getting ready for this. And I was listening to Wonderland, which obviously, you know, was a number 114 smash or whatever. but it sounds like a new pop record. I've seen people kind of making an kind of apology for Mama, saying, well, you know, those songs couldn't have been hits in the era of Culture Club and Spandau Ballet. And it's like, well, the last time I checked, Love is a Wonderful Colour was a hit. And the last time I checked, The First Picture of You was a hit. So why on earth Wonderland wasn't a hit doesn't make a great deal of sense to me.
No, I think sonically, you're right, it perfectly fitted. And they got Steve Nye in, of course. And Steve Nye had worked with Japan and was working with Sylvian at the time. And I think that sonically, it fits. The songwriting, to me, is uniformly really inventive. What I like about this is that every single one of the 10 songs has its own unique song world, sound world. Absolutely, I think it does fit in. And Big Express, you know, with its, I know it's controversial because of its use of Lynn drums and what have you, but once more, that was not out of context with what was happening at the time. And of course, you know, if you think of The Police being huge with Synchronicity, there was a certain crossover of sound with XTC and The Police during that mid-80s period as well.
Yeah, totally. I mean, listening to Human Alchemy is not dissimilar to the kind of territory that had been occupied by The Police. I think it's a lot more colourful and interesting, but it's not like so outlandish as to be unrecognisable.
No. Well, I seem to sort of remember interviews at the time with Andy Partridge, and I once actually mentioned it to Andy because I was sure I read that he was saying that no one could ever be as serious as David Bowie for an entire career. There was something along that, the lines of that, and that he found a lot of his ideas on the toilet, but I think he felt the journalist had invented this. But I do remember him saying that he felt at the time that Virgin were kind of treating them as eccentrics in the way that they were treating Henry Cow in the 70s, that suddenly they sold enough records to be kept on by the label, but that was it. You know, there was no enthusiasm and no desire to break them. And this was just pre-skylarking becoming massive in the States. That I think there was a sense that XTC were being a bit neglected by Virgin.
It is a double-edged sword, though, because when they stopped, when Andy put the brakes on and they cancelled the rest of the US tour and the whole machinery, which was really just gearing up because of the success, the relative success of English Settlement, the whole record company machinery, the whole thing was pushing them towards America. There was going to be a big tour, and there was, you know, potentially some kind of traction was being gained. And that's what happens when bands just elevate that extra level. When they start to play bigger places, the stakes become higher, more money comes in, they make more money from touring, they make more money from record sales and so on. And the whole machinery was all moving forward. And I don't wonder if, I mean, it's pure speculation, but I don't wonder if Andy at the time, that was part of his illness, you know, his fear, his anxiety towards not just being brutally extracted from a kind of high-functioning Valium, you know, well, not addiction. I don't know if he was addicted, but being taking off Valium that had been on for a long time, having this kind of sort of, I don't know. I just do wonder that if maybe the old machinery and everything was a little bit too frightening. And so he put the brakes on, and that's kind of by extension, possibly why Mummer is a smaller sounding and more considered sounding record, because he just, everything stopped. They all came home. Virgin were probably thinking, well, what the fuck? We have all these promoters to play, you know, to pay. You know, you're in a hole now. And then the hole, and that's the beginning of the rot, you know, setting in with the relationship with Virgin Records. And here's Andy sat in his garden with his acoustic guitar, probably, writing Lady Bird. And to me, you can hear that. It's like it's throughout a lot of the record, especially a song like Lady Bird to me, which I think is their best song. But, well, in my humble, obviously. But I remember reading Chris's book, I think, you know, about that incident, about just him retiring to his garden and just writing or finishing whatever songs he had in his catchment, which went on to become Mummer. And I think something like Lady Blood is sort of emblematic of that period of him just wanting to regain a bit of control over his life. So again, it's like a double-edged sword. He may have complained about Virgin's disinterest and stuff, but he did temper everything at a very vital moment, you know. And I think Mummer is a result of that as well. You know, it's a change, and the sound of English Settlement and Black Sea especially is big drums, big guitars, the Hugh Padgham stone room at the townhouse, the clattering, and not all of it, but the overriding kind of mood is, you know, it's there's a size and a weight to it. And Mummer has moments like that, but really it changes. It becomes more widescreen and less, you know, sort of demonstrative. Obviously keyboards come in, but they're very careful. Steve Nye's obviously very careful not to make this keyboard sound like new pop. Doesn't sound like Howard Jones or, you know, Nick Kershaw or anything, that he'll reamp the keyboards to make them just provide a little bit more of an organic sound, provide that one level of remove that is kind of needed. And, you know, they make this whole different record. But to me, Mummer is entirely a reaction to that one kind of rather seismic event where they just, you know, where Partridge just said no more. But, you know,
well, isn't it also possibly where Andy Partridge finds his his natural voice? Because as a singer prior to this, and I remember him talking about the barking seal, which was his early vocal style. And on this, he is Andy Partridge. There's something about their influences from the 60s coming really naturally through, but in quite an organic 1980s way. You know, it's a state-of-the-art, glistening production, but they seem at one with themselves. And I guess this leads to you know, eventually it leads to the Dukes of Stratosphere, which ironically was the thing that I remember the music press getting very excited about. And a lot of friends I had at the time, that was the project that suddenly they really got into XTC again, Dukes of Stratosphere. You know, it is this kind of coming to terms with where they've come from and with themselves, you know.
I think Colin too. Colin's got a couple of blinding vocals on the album as well.
Yeah, yeah.
And Loving Memory of a Name, absolutely. And it feels like he's made a bit of a change in his vocal style also. There's this very sonorous, melodic strength coming out in his voice in places now.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering whether there's, because I agree with everything that Crawford's saying, but I also wonder whether whether it's a slight, only a slight mistake to see the whole album through that idea of Andy writing Lady Bird in his back garden, because, you know, there is a song about slavery on it. There is a song about, you know, death and you know, military sacrifice on it. You know, it's not as capital P political as English Settlement, with, you know, where you've got song after song after song that aren't quite strident themes, but it is actually much more adventurous than that image of somebody writing about a ladybird in the back garden might suggest.
Well, it's one of my slight bugbears with reading about, and it's not even the sort of press reaction, it's the sort of general fan mentality towards Mumma. People sort of go, oh yeah, that's the pastoral one, and they tick the box and move on. Mm. It's like, it is not a pastoral record at all. There's like, where's the pasture?
I would disagree. I think it is that parts of it, there are definite corners of it. And there's two songs about farming.
I know, but then like, one of them's a really, like, I mean, I'm not saying it's not completely absent of pastoral, but it is not in any sense a pastoral album. You know, there's moments of great fullness and violence on it.
Mm.
You know, Human Alchemy is not pastoral.
Yeah, and there's moments as well where you can hear aspects of things like Talking Heads, David Byrne, what they're up to at the time. You know, it's quite rhythmic on occasion. And I think as well, I always kind of hear a slight undercurrent of the dissonance of King Crimson coming through. But maybe that's me.
but I think it's interesting, Tim, that you identified your three XTC albums as Apple Venus, Skylarking and Mumma, all of which you could put into that category of the non-violent ones, the softer ones.
Though I think this is arguably the less pastoral of those, or at least, you know, it's the least... how can I put this? I think the others are quite... complete. I mean, bar obviously the song Sean hates, but the others are quite complete. You know, Apple Venus is a beautiful singer-songwriter album with gorgeous arrangements. Skylarking is, you know, such a beautifully constructed piece of work that I can forgive it being long in the CD age. You know, I just adore that album. And this does have a few quite hard-hitting political and rhythmically complicated outliers compared to Apple Venus and Skylarking.
And I think there's one thing that I like about it is that all the way through there's just kind of slightly disconcerting, jarring bits. You know, it's often just in the outro of a song you'll suddenly get a new idea coming in, and it just is enough to unsettle you. And I was kind of thinking what you were talking about, Tim, about each song having its own sound world. I think it's also true of the album as a whole, that it has its own sound, you know, it has a unified sound as an album. It struck me as quite interesting what you said, that each song has its own sound world, because I think of the album as almost like a single suite, because everything fits together so well.
Right. I think that's because the sequencing on it is so good, actually, as an album, really, that it fits. Mm. Because, you know, yeah, if you do think of things like Human Alchemy, what relationship does that have sonically with Love and a Farm Boy's Wages or Lady Bird? Mm-hmm. Not mm-hmm. very much, really.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm thinking as well also of Beating of Hearts. Despite having a very sort of positive, upbeat message as an opener, it's you have to work it. And Crawford mentioned that it took you a little bit of a while to get into it, and maybe that was one of the reasons for that.
I don't think it's an easy record. It's not an instantly likable record, I think, in the main. At least not to me, it wasn't. I mean, but I was only like about 17, perhaps, when I heard it for the first time, 16. Your palate develops for weirdness, and there is a fair amount of strange elements on Mumma, or strange-ish elements, I guess. Certain songs, like Wonderland, took me a long time to get into, and Human Alchemy I never warmed to until... And Great Fire a little bit, but I think it's just there's always a piece of an XTC. If there's even an XTC song that you don't particularly, you're not particularly keen on, there's usually a bit of it that is really good, and somehow it's sort of, that is the seed that kind of grows. You know, like Human Alchemy is I would argue this maybe like the most easily dislikable tune on the record from like just first exposure to it. It's very narrow melodically until that sort of B section where it all kind of opens up. There's a lot of air in it, you know. It kind of, maybe you could argue, maybe goes on a little bit too long, and it has a sort of typical self-dubbing kind of XTC outro at the end. It's sort of flinty and, you know, and grey sounding in the main sections and so things like that. But I think that is part of what, you know, people's relationship with a good album, that you might not like at first, and then you just grow to love it, and it just becomes part of your life. And there's a lot of, it's a very reciprocal record for me, Mama. I get a lot from it, and I don't get tired of it. Like some of the records I have to stop listening to after a while, because I want to come back to them and not be sick of them. And Mama, I feel like I can listen to continuously. And it might be that little part of it, that some of the arrangements of songs are just keeping you at arm's length a little bit. It might be that. It's not too eager to please.
Maybe the cover sort of enhances the impression people have, because I know that this wasn't the intended cover that Andy had for it, but there's something quite vague and mysterious about it, far more so than any previous XTC cover, which tends to be more direct. And I wonder if that kind of, in a way, psychologically impacts on how people confront the album, you know.
I've got a theory about that.
Or if the album reflects.
Okay, but I'll make a very, very quick comparison. I was thinking about this, and I was wondering if, like, you have, like, English Settlement and a Mummer, and a Big Express and Skylarking with the Jukes in between. And if you look at somebody like, I was thinking about Joni Mitchell, you have Blue, and then you have For the Roses, and then you have, I think, Court and Spark. Now, nobody gives a single shit about For the Roses at all. They just don't. It's a fucking great album. It has some of her best songs on it. It has, you know, Cold Blue Steel and Sweet Fire on it, and it'll just be for fuck's sake. But yeah, it just seems to be in a hole. It's got a terrible cover. It's got a really, really awful cover.
Mean, it's possible. Although it did open up, if you saw the vinyl edition, it was kind of quite special. But yeah, I agree, it's not the best of covers. But yeah, an amazing album, and it does, you're right, entirely slips through the cracks. And I'm not quite sure why, to be honest.
I think it's so, because it's between these two, you know, megalithic kind of like moments in music, you know?
But strangely, I might prefer it, because I think the arrangements on it are so gorgeous, so complicated. You know, the Tom Scott work on that album.
It's a fantastic record, yeah, it really is, and sadly overlooked. Much like Mama.
Sean, do you have anything to say about the sound world that I was just referring to, and that Tim was talking on a song-by-song basis? But it's also, actually, just before we started the podcast, we were talking about Mellotrons, but there are lots of just sort of odd, organic-y sort of sounding sounds on the record, but that give it its flavour.
Yeah, there's a lot to say. I mean, I know this is heresy, really. I'm not a great fan of English Settlement. I think it's too long. I think it sounds very monochromatic, and I think a lot of the songs are really not that great, and the songs themselves often go on too long, as well as there being too many of them. Now, I know that's an unpopular opinion. And the other thing is that, like, if you don't like the sound of Townhouse Studio 2 with the Stone Room, then you're going to get sick of that record really, really quickly, because you're going to be hearing an awful lot of it. And one of the nice things about Mama is, and especially having come off the back of Tin Drum, which is a record that I absolutely adore, Japan's Tin Drum, which Steve and I also produced, which is a gorgeously put together and engineered and very, mostly reverb-free, especially on the rhythm section, you know, very concentrated and focused sounding album. And that's one of the things that I really like about Mama. It's like, I know that there's that quote from Andy Partridge where he said it's like the first time they went into Technicolor. But interestingly, I don't think it's the first time they tried to do widescreen. And I think it's not a widescreen record. I think it's a record that's very solidly in 4:3 or Academy ratio if it was a film. If it was a film, it would be directed by Andrea Arnold, not Stanley Kubrick. You know, it's quite emotive, but it has a little bit of distance. It's in a frame that feels slightly too close for comfort. And it's all the more beautiful for it, really. And I like the fact that it's on that cusp technologically of being, you know, we now have analog synthesizers with memories. So yes, presets exist. And they've got some old tech. They've gone out and bought a Mellotron. But it's before the Lexicon reverb came on and gave everybody the 10-second reverb on a snare that became de rigueur from like 1984 onwards. And also, crucially, it's before the DX7 landed, because you mentioned Howard Jones and Nick Kershaw earlier. And both of them, I think, are really great songwriters, but there's quite a lot of their material where it's like, if you could just go back in time and just set fire to the DX7 or buy them a programming manual, one or the other, but if they use the presets, then they're going to prison, then it would, those records would be so much better. And the great thing about Mama is that it's too early for that. You know, it's still got that kind of slightly faux naive quality of Colin messing about with their old Korg monosynth at home, because they've now got the Prophet 5, so he's nicked it. And those older analog polysynths have got a kind of organic quality, which the later digital polysynths just don't. So the world of Mama is sort of quite sort of dry and close and has a certain amount of warmth to it, but it's only got as much warmth as they have deigned to allow, you know? And I think it's very carefully controlled. And I think the world of it is a really beautiful world because of all of those things. And also, like Tim mentioned the sequencing earlier, and it is an expertly sequenced record because, you know, put in any other order, it would seem really bumpy. But there's something about the way the 10 songs go together that whether you can start the album with like a kind of slightly raga, you know, Duke's Anticipating freak out, and end it with something which is sort of not dissimilar to something the Beat might have been doing in the same era, and yet make them feel like they're part of the same record. And that takes great skill.
I think Steve Nye is really important as well, because he would reamp keyboards. I think even back then, at the beginning of the 80s, he realized that it wasn't cool or functional to just plug a keyboard straight into the mixing desk and wash a lot of reverb on it, and it might sound big and impressive. And I was doing a little bit of reading up to see, there's not many interviews with him. And the one interview I could find from about 1987, the guy actually went to great lengths to say about how difficult he was, which kind of, I guess that, you know, coincides with Andy's comments over the years. But I was listening to some of the rough mixes of Mama that kind of came out, and it's interesting to hear some of the monitor mixes, like Ladybird, for instance, is a little bit more kind of pub piano jangly and a little bit more bouncy and stuff. And it's a little bit more Beatly, a little bit more Math of My Day or something. And it's, I think Steve Nye's kind of, his way of mixing is to kind of reduce it slightly and just tie everything down and I think that's why they remixed set. I remember Andy saying they remixed some of the songs to put some of the guts back in them. And that's maybe a little bit harsh, but I guess Steve Nye's just his beautiful engineering skills. He was good at sort of just tying things down. And I guess that's, and I think that's exactly what you were saying, Sean, that, you know, that it's pulled this, the screen, you know, the frame of, you know, around the songs in to kind of tightly control them. But I think they definitely dodged the bullet. That's one of the things you hear about Mumbers. People say, oh, it's really 80s sounding. It's got all these keyboards and stuff.
No, but it's actually not.
But actually the key, yeah, I know. And the keyboards are, you know, they went a long way to program those prophets and stuff to make them sound weather beaten, to make them sound like it's been a keyboard that's been left out in the rain for a month, you know? and that's how the album has kind of, like, to me, has dodged that kind of what you're saying of digital reverbs and stuff coming in a year later. Maybe if, I mean, there's a whole extra argument of Big Express, but I know Andy's gone a long way to say, well, actually, Pete Phipps is all over that record and I don't know what you're talking about. And I think that people's attitudes towards Big Express have changed slightly over the years because of that, where they listen to it and gone, oh, actually, yeah, I mean, I don't care anymore that, you know, it's that particular, you know, has a slightly more kind of boxy reverb production.
Tim, on this line, for those who haven't listened to the Album Years podcast, you should. But if you haven't, the idea of the Album Years is that you choose a year and you talk about all the albums that were released in it and do so very eloquently and interestingly. But I just wonder, the process of going through year by year, those podcasts, are there some... what's your reaction on what Crawford's saying about that sense of certain years and certain technologies sticking to records in a way that sometimes people, and I think XTC on the whole transcend this, and I'm not too sure exactly how they do.
I think you're entirely, I entirely agree with what Crawford's saying. And I think that it's interesting what Sean was saying as well. I think 83 might have been the last year. Because if you listen, you know, Tin Drum, as we say, superb production, but as 80s as it is, it's utterly unique. It's utterly itself, I think. You know, very tight, very claustrophobic, almost airless kind of production, but utterly brilliant. And I know that Andy was obsessed with it and wanted to bring aspects of that into XTC, which Dave Gregory didn't feel suited XTC. But yes, I think that the late 70s, early 80s was an incredibly exciting time with people playing with the possibilities of technology. It was, you know, I love that period because I think a lot of the old guard musicians were shaken up and producing some of their greatest music. You know, Peter Gabriel III, Peter Gabriel IV, people like Rupert Hine producing Immunity, Bill Nelson in his pomp, in a way. You know, these were people who were producing astonishing work during this period. Woke them up. And then I think 84, everything became more ossified, if that makes sense, that, you know, people were using the presets, were using the Lindrum, the DX7 in thoroughly unimaginative ways, and production became a lot glossier. And also the nature of singing became thoroughly stylized and affected. And I think that the interesting thing for me, and it's what I think you've all alluded to, is that on Mama, it isn't 80s in the sense that Colin Moulding and Andy Partridge have never sounded better or more natural. They're actually, like Richard Barbieri was on Tin Drum, they're programming this prophet. They're not just using cheap, easy sounds. You know, there's a lot of intelligence. What I love about, you know, Mama, even thinking of the first track, Beating of Hearts, the when I think it's louder than the bombs and there's that sudden plunge, that depth sound, it's wonderfully rich. And if you're listening to it on headphones, it has a real impact. You know, every detail is thought out, which I think is both Andy, XTC, and probably Steve Nye as well. But yeah, I think eras, for better or worse, can define sounds. And one of the things on the album is that we sort of discussed was that in 86, what was kind of interesting, and there are exceptions to this, and Colour of Spring and Skylarking are definite exceptions to this. But what was interesting about that sort of 84 to 87 period is you could get an album from Miles Davis, The Cars, The Wooden Tops, and actually they'd sound remarkably similar.
I remember you saying that on the podcast. I'm totally agreeing when I was listening to it and thinking, God, yeah, that's so right. It's like there's this kind of like similarity of sound. And
it's all Live Aid's fault. It is. I'm not even joking. I mean, I know it was all for a good cause and it was all a wonderful thing, but it is all Live Aid's fault because it was the end of let's allow art students with funny haircuts and, you know, strange ideas, let's give them the major label money. It's like, no, now let's give it to people who want a synclavier and who sing a bit like Bill Withers.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. You know, because before 1985, you had, you know, Strawberry Switchblade and you had Japan and you had The Associates. And then after 1985, you have Living in a Box, you know?
And people who can play in stadiums.
People who can play, full stop.
But some of those bands were badly affected. I mean, XTC were not. David Sylvian wasn't. Talk Talk weren't. Blue Nile. So there were some artists who transcended that. But, you know, you think of The Associates, who, again, you know, one of my favourite bands of the early 80s, and Sulk, I think, is a peerless piece of work. But even by the mid-80s, you can see how Billy McKenzie has lost his way in a studio with external producers. And it sounds a lot like what's out there. And when you've got one of the most unique vocalists in pop history sounding like everyone else, you know this is a strange time. Mm.
I think you could say that it's quite similar now, actually, because we've landed in an era where, like, individuality is kind of the last thing that's necessary to be a pop star. It's like, you now, everyone subscribes to Splice in the same way they do to Netflix, and they get paid 10 quid a month to get the same samples that absolutely everybody else is using, and they put them together like Lego to get an appealing kind of day glow effect. And then you use the, you know, snare drum du jour, and you have to have the production effect du jour, and you have the feature du jour. And it's like, and the consequence is that I know that I'm not saying everything was great when I was young, because it wasn't, because 95% of pop music has always been terrible, and that's never going to change. But I'd say that, like, it's probably up to about 97% at the moment. And it's a bit of a shame. It's like, because individuality seems to have been slightly stripped out of the process. And I think a lot of that was what was happening in that post-Live Aid era as well, certainly in the pop charts.
It all comes down to personal curation, because we don't really have much of a record industry anymore. There's not record companies, for better or worse. were curators, and they had this, they have this strange business model where they would invest in 30 bands, maybe three of them would make the money, and the rest, the other 17, would be carried by that money, and some of them would be dropped, and then 3 years later, another crop of bands would come in. And it was just an insane, it's an insane model. It's an insane idea when you think about it. So no wonder people have nothing good to say about record companies from that point of view.
One of the things about individuality that Sean was raising is actually in the songwriting as well. And I can remember when the album came out and Love on a Farm Boy's Wages must have been on the radio. And I was a student at the time and my flatmate had heard it on the radio. And she just thought it was incredibly naff, this idea about singing about being on a farm. And there was an element I thought, yeah, even then, although I liked the song, I was conscious it wasn't the sort of, even now, who sings about farm boys? It's very... it's so singular and idiosyncratic. And it's not at all claiming any kind of place in the rock and roll repertoire. It goes off in its own direction. Same with I'm just looking at the track listing. You know, Colin singing about graveyards and
yeah, but we had a sea shanty at number one for 3 weeks or 6 weeks or whatever it was, a year and a half ago, and then we have that C word singing about sausage rolls every Christmas.
So there is a place for individuality, but I think there's something fantastic about the way that Andy and Colin were just prepared to go in their own direction, and they weren't following the rock and roll. Even their love songs don't quite sound like love songs. They're going in their own direction.
The way that they are kind of, I don't know how, without looking at every single song to make a judgment call, but I like the way that Andy and Colin's kind of personal conceits with songwriting sort of intersect generally fairly, and the Venn diagrams do overlap quite largely. There's a lot of about, you know, he sings Deliver Us From the Elements, which is about, you know, the man's, you know, how we're dependent on the weather just to be able to eat, but from the perspective of probably from hundreds of years ago, you know. So there are these sort of naive, sort of old world kind of conceits in both of their songs. And I like how they and Colin's, a lot of Colin's writing has always been about, you know, small, personal, you know, your own personal sphere, and about small town life, and that's always kind of come out. And Andy has written about that, you know, Miles. So I love the fact that they both, even though the songs are often very different, they still have this. There is a commonality between the two, you know, the two songwriting conceits that they adopt.
Would anybody like to make a case for Funk Pop a Roll being on this album? I'm wondering whether it should really be on the next album rather than this album.
Well, it anticipates the next album, doesn't it? I think it's a good ending. And I think, obviously, it sort of blends a note of cynicism and immediate reality as well, doesn't it? Because I think, as Crawford says, what's interesting about this is that XTC, you know, I remember making plans for Nigel at school. Incredibly popular. You know, this is what XTC were known for. But they were kind of a cutting-edge pop band with quirks. And I think by this stage, what's interesting is, whereas, you know, you listen to the early band and in some ways they're either very present or they're suggesting the future, there's something, despite the glistening production on Mama, where they seem to have come from another time. They almost seem to have come from 19th century in some way. And I think it's in the lyrics, it's in their own imagery in a way. And I think they seem oblivious to the concerns of the modern world. I know there are political songs on this, but this is one of the few, Funk Pop a Roll, where it's almost bringing it into the present and adding a note of cynicism. But it's one of the things I always kind of liked about XTC and Skylarking, which obviously was internationally a huge album, at least in my imagination, it was internationally a huge album, has these kind of almost antique, ancient, rustic concerns. And it's one of the qualities about XTC I rather like.
I feel like it was almost deliberately Neanderthal Funk Pop a Roll. You know, it's him dumbing himself down, but not being able to go all the way. Like when you listen to the section, you know, they can fix you rabbits up that section. It's basically like, you know, that cowbell and the seventh chord. It's like you can't do that by the Beatles. It's like he's going, well, what's a popular song? Well, let's just shoehorn something that sounds like the Beatles, you know. And then it's quite kind of thuddy. You know, it's that 70s glam and a bit of Beatles and a bit of all the rest. And I think that's kind of what... I'd love to know what music it was, whether it was the beginnings of new pop that he was thinking about when he was writing it. You know, I wonder what the music, what particular part of the music scene he was looking at.
Yeah, or whether they were lost in their own world, because that is the thing about skylarking, that you can't really hear anything surrounding it that sounds like it. And I'm sure, you know, Todd Rundgren is a part of that as well. I mean, his production and his sequencing is superb on that album as well. He deserves a lot of credit.
I mean, I really like Funk Popper Roll, and I think it's a good sort of, I mean, at the end of the album's not really where you should have a palate cleanser, but you know what I mean. It's like as a kind of, you know, sweeping away of what has gone before. It's extremely effective, and it's a really good song. And I also think that, I don't know if you're familiar with the Les McQueen character from The League of Gentlemen, who's a kind of, was on the cusp of the music industry in the 70s and never quite got there. And he's like, oh, it's a shit business, you'll find out. And if ever there was a band who deserved to write several albums worth of it's a shit business, it's XTC. And so the fact there's so few of those songs in their catalogue means that when one comes along, you do sort of think, whether you like it or not, and I do like it, you know, I think Andy's earned the right to have a moan.
Particularly at that point where he had been spat out by the music industry, hadn't he? You know, that
like
was...
everything that could have gone wrong for them went wrong. I mean, you look at their career as like an object lesson on the business side of how not to do it. You know, you've got a manager that I better not say anything about. And then you've got a record label who is on side. And I think, you know, I have to give Virgin in this era some credit because they did stick with them. And yes, they had to renegotiate for a worse royalty rate and do another six albums and all the rest of it. But they stuck with this non-touring band who sold in medium amounts. They stuck with them and let them keep going and keep making records. And there's a lot to be said for that. But in the main, yeah, they, you know, they got screwed over. They didn't get paid properly. They had to audit them twice before they got any money out of them. And all the stories we know. So yeah, I think, you know, Andy, it's fair enough that he wanted to say on at least one song.
It's also not a super bitter record. The lyrics, they're not really that bitter. It's more like advice. Like, he's kind of good at advice. His love songs are often based around it. Like, you think of something like Jump, for instance. You know, it's just about gently kind of moving someone towards a situation. And I don't feel like, you know, because it's not unpalatable. Funk Popper, I don't. Personally, I would maybe nudge it out and put The World is Full of Angry Young Men on the album somewhere and maybe end with, I don't know. I was thinking, actually, I had written down, Andy tweeted out a different proposed, or something about the original proposed running order for Mama. He tweeted it in 2017, and it's Beating of Hearts, Wonderland, Love on a Farmboy's Wages, Jump, Young Cleopatra, The World is Full of Angry Young Men, Motorcycle Landscape, Ladybird, Gold, In Loving Memory of a Name, and then Desert Island or Happy Families, and then Deliver Us from the Elements. So there's two or three kind of unreleased tracks in there, and then No Human Alchemy, No Great Fire, No Me, No Wind, No Funk Popper Roll, which I thought was quite interesting.
Very interesting, yeah.
It's like he's trying to kind of mess with history.
Putting Motorcycle Landscape on it, I mean, I re-listened to it recently, and it's mental. I mean, it's really noisy. It's a bit like Rain of Blows, you know, on Big Express. It's got that kind of, it's bangy, crashy kind of sound, and it definitely would have altered the shape of the record. I'm not so sure about Happy Families either. I've never been so fond of that, or Desert Island, but I like The World is Full of Angry Young Men. That could have fitted on, but maybe they just didn't want two songs that were quite overtly jazzy on the record. Maybe they just wanted to go with Lady Bird.
I'm also thinking about the closing songs on so many XTC albums, which are, you know, apocalyptic. It's Complicated Game, it's Travels in Nihilon, you know, those big moments. And Funk Popper Roll doesn't quite fit into that, doesn't quite have that sort of enormity about it. It's although it finishes with the word bye-bye, which is, I remember at the time, I think people at the time thought it was a sort of, that was Andy signing out altogether from the music industry, which I don't believe it was.
Well, this running order ends with Deliver Us from the Elements, which has quite a kind of apocalyptic,
yeah, that would
windy
do.
Kind of conclusion, so that would work.
Yeah. Tim and Sean, I'm interested for you as songwriters, and I know, Crawford, you're musical as well. I'm wondering whether you could identify what you have learnt from that album in terms of songwriting craft. Sean, I know, for example, in What Do You Call That Noise, the book, you talked about Love on a Farm Boy's Wages as a, you know, a fantastic song. Are these songs that you can identify that you've learnt from?
It's really hard to say. It's like, I've been sort of doing what I do for so long that sometimes when influences creep in later, you're more blind to them, because it's the things that were really elemental for you when you were starting that it's more easy to define what effect they had on you and what you learned from them. I mean, I'm sure I will have learned something, because I have listened to this record like a lot. So I'm sure there will be influence from it that will have kind of drip fed in. What the actual outcome of that might be, it's kind of hard for me to say. It's like, I suppose if there's any lesson to be learned, it's like, you know, this is a really good record that's really true to itself.
Mm-hmm.
That isn't like, even the ones which are like, oh, Andy, if there's no single, can you write as a single? And he writes Great Fire in 10 minutes. The bastard. And it's not even slightly normal. You know, it's kind of normal when it gets to the chorus, but it's like this kind of clumpy waltz. You know, and I was thinking about this morning when I was listening to it, because, you know, if you're Virgin and they're like, well, we need a single, and then you send them Great Fire and they go, great, this is it. And from the perspective of now, you kind of look at it and go, wow, really? But then if you listen to Senses Working Overtime, the band's sole top 10 hit.
Yeah.
Like, I remember that being on music television about 17 or 18 years ago. My then teenage nephew was watching it with me, and he was howling with laughter at this bloke with his funny voice singing his kind of funny song, like with his hey hey and all the rest of it, because it doesn't really get, I mean, I think it's brilliant, but it doesn't really get going as a recognizable pop song until quite a way in, and Great Fire is similar. But I think, yeah, I mean, a few years ago, before everything happened, I was asked to do a kind of industry panel thing at some sort of seminar, and it was all about the future of songwriting. And I sort of said, the thing about songwriting is the future of songwriting is really the past of songwriting. There's not, like, tastes will change. But the really important thing is, like, if you want to be a pop songwriter, which particularly I don't anymore, but if I did, it's like, what you have to do is study the form and learn to work inside it. And then if you want to be an iconoclast and you want to do your own thing, then just do that. And just be the best iconoclast you can be. Be the best you that you can be. And if there's a lesson to be taken away from Mama, it's that, you know, listen to what Andy and Colin do as songwriters. Listen to how, you know, dedicated and true to themselves they are. They do exactly what they feel is right. And they have enough, you know, craft to be able to put it in a context where it's listenable for people outside the circle. And I think that's always something that every songwriter should be aiming for.
Yeah, and Tim, that's reminding me, a lot of the stuff that Burning Shed promotes is on the prog side of things, and that there's that sort of crossover that XTC, I find quite surprising, because I've never thought, until recently, I never really thought of XTC as being prog, but yeah. that definition of prog in its purest sense, I suppose, of being adventurous and literally progressive, perhaps that could be applied here, because they are going
their direction. I think they fitted perfectly with it, really. I think partly it's in the complexity of their music and their compositions that they fit with a kind of a prog mindset, and it's partly because they are thoroughly themselves and idealistic, and partly because they have throughout their career shifted gear several times as well. You know, they wrong foot the listener. So in some ways they are one of those bands that tangentially fit perfectly with a kind of a progressive rock audience's appetite for music, and I can see how they fit in. You know, if you think of a band like Big Big Train, in some ways I would kind of think that they fused the pastoral Selling England by the Pound era Genesis with something of that quite complicated Beatlesque XTC songwriting. You know, I can see that in their DNA. So I can sort of see that. But yeah, I mean, with Burning Shed, we mostly do what sort of art, pop art rock, prog rock, psychedelia. There's a lot of music in there that we deal with, and XTC are beloved of almost every single genre fan, you know, bar perhaps people coming in from the metal side, really. And I can see that. But it's interesting to talk about Great Fire, which I thought was a wonderful single. That was played at my son's there was a bonfire at his primary school a couple of years ago before everything happened. And Great Fire was played, and I was delighted that obviously one of the teachers must be a fan. And going back to the early part of the conversation with this, you know, the nature of pop and the nature of what XTC did, is that I think that, yes, things are bad now, and why things are bad, and that's not to say, once more, things were always bad. If you think, you know, yes, 95% of everything is utter shit. If we go back 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s.
It was
90s,
a different kind of there band. Is. I think now.
It was a different
it's,
kind
of band. It's a much more strategically marketed, correctly commodified kind of bad. I think it's been sharpened to such a sharp point now that nobody can do anything kind of bad, really.
Well, what kind of happened? You know, there are a few things that are kind of interesting. I mean, you know, XTC was signed in a way on the back of the punk revolution. This is what was great. You know, going back to something Crawford saying, and I think Zappa said this, that one of the glorious things that when Zappa was signed, the labels didn't know what they were doing. They were actually ignorant of the currents of popular culture and what the youth wanted. So they'd signed 10 bands. And in those 10 bands, they had the Mothers of Invention, the Velvet Underground, and 8 that were probably uninteresting. But they didn't know what they had in the Velvet Underground or Zappa. Similarly, in the year of punk, you know, people like Elvis Costello were signed. You know, Elvis Costello, punk, in a sense, it is absurd. You know, he's a great classic songwriter who, again, like XTC, has shifted his perspective as he's evolved. And XTC was signed in the slipstream of that. When No Man was signed, we were signed, and it's bizarre to think of this, we were signed in the slipstream of Madchester. It was 1990. It was almost any band with dance beats and a guitar was signed, but the companies didn't know what we were doing. And of course, you know, within one album, we were doing 11 minute ambient symphonies, you know. So it's like, and what was kind of interesting is that, yeah, going back to what Croft's saying, artists defined themselves. Artists, in a sense, used to, in a sense, want to surprise. Whereas now, if you think of the popular end of the charts, the popular end of music, a bit like that dead period in the mid-80s, people are following. So now it's rather than determining where people go and actually saying, you know what, I'm going to do Sgt. Pepper's, I'm going to do Smile, I'm going to produce something that will absolutely blow people's minds apart and stretch the limits of my ability. Now people are chasing the tail of other artists. It's almost like it's difficult to explain, but, you know, you look at a pop song, the BPMs are remarkably similar, the chord sequences are remarkably similar. Very few people are producing that Strawberry Fields Forever, as an example, which absolutely throws the idea of pop out of the water. You know, it redefines it with new sonics, new ideas, sometimes incredibly simple ones. It doesn't have to be complicated. And yeah, you know, I think XTC are part of that post-Beatles progressive pop era where they were redefining themselves with every single album, one, being true to themselves, but two, stretching their abilities and stretching the possibilities of sound. You know, and luckily they were gifted enough to do that.
I mean, the amazing thing with XTC is that, like, they kind of held off for a long time, allowing those influences to sink into their music. But when they did,
yeah,
they didn't sort of just regurgitate them whole. I mean, you think about the 90s when Britpop happened. And, you know, the ultimate expression of it is Oasis being like, you know, the Beatles were their favourite band. And it's funny because, you know, there's no invention in any of their songwriting or production that suggests that they have ever actually listened to a Beatles record. What it actually sounds like is they had Imagine on repeat, like the Imagine album. And it feels like there's that sort of thing where there was no way to, you know, the band who couldn't correctly synthesize their influences. It was just they could kind of, it was just sort of, well, something came in, something came out. There wasn't a sense of like, it came in and was processed and came back out as something else new because it had been synthesized by like the band's own influences. You know, I think that's where XTC excelled at, is that even when they would say, you know, they would do something a bit Beatly or they would do a Beach Boys thing, in the main, it would not be pastiche. And pastiche, I think, is one of the worst things that any band can do. I think if you've got a band and you're really good at pastiching something, then you need to fire the person in the band who makes it easier for you to do that, you know, because it just straight away makes you less interesting if you can't fail in an interesting way, you know, if you can sort of say, like, because I can't really play anything, I program and I sing and I can put things together, but I can't shred in any meaningful way, which means if you gave me a task to try and do something in the style of, like, it might come out sort of terrible, but it won't come out as a photocopy because I don't have the chops. So it will, by definition, be an interesting failure.
Yeah, yeah. Now, a lot of great pop music is made by accident. It's made because Absolutely. You don't have the ability. And yes, I think as well that, you know, XTC were clearly widely listened. And I think that a lot of the artists, I mean, going back to the thing you're saying, why do they appeal to, say, progressive rock fans, is that maybe progressive rock bands listen to classical, listen to folk. You know, they'd be as aware of Messiaen as Bert Jansch, as Bob Dylan, as the Beatles. And I think actually Andy Partridge is, you know, he has a tremendously eclectic set of influences that go well outside of rock music. And also he has, you know, quite a vibrant inner life and an emotional life that's filtered through the music. Yeah, I think, you know, pastiche, you know, one of the things with Oasis, I think, is partly they didn't necessarily have the musical ability as well as the imagination to go past that, as you say, Imagine, which obviously was a simplified form of Lennon's songwriting. I mean, you know, I don't mind the Imagine album personally, but it's clearly a stripped down and musically simplified piece of work compared to what he was doing with the Beatles.
Yeah, I mean, I just sort of feel like, you know, I don't think technical incompetence should really get in the way of making good records.
No,
it helps
no.
If you're great. But, you know, the Slits can't play at all, and they were amazing.
No, yeah. good point, because I think a lot of the late 70s, early 80s bands were filled with non-musicians who were just spectacularly inventive in terms of their use of sound. I mean, you know, again, to go back to Japan, none of them were trained, none of them were traditional musicians, and they were finding their feet in this new world of technology, making accidents as much as anything else, and then sculpting them quite brilliantly.
It's reminding me that Love on a Farm Boy's Wages is folk. It was covered by the Poozies at one point, I seem to remember. And
the first time I heard it was the Poozies version.
Was that right? Yeah, yeah, which is really lovely. And Lady Bird is jazz without this album sounding like a jazz album or a folk album. But those influences are just sort of organically mixed in with everything else, aren't they?
Well, it's that great thing of, like, Love on a Farm Boy's Wages. It's like it's more folk because of the way that it's dressed up lyrically. I mean, musically, it doesn't really have anything particular in common with a folk record.
An acoustic guitar, maybe.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you're going to say an acoustic guitar makes a folk record, then that means, like, I think Ed Sheeran's a folk artist, which, let's be clear, he is not.
I think the percussion's quite low-key in a way, you know, it's sort of pattery, and I think Andy described it as nattering kind of percussion. I think it's maybe more to do with general atmosphere, you know, the sort of played-down element of the whole thing is a little bit folky. I wouldn't say it's a folk. Yeah, I mean,
yeah. Well, the title as well, the farm boy aspect, I think leads the perception towards that folkness as well, doesn't it?
And presumably that's why the Poozies picked up on it.
I mean, it's just it's own thing.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I agree.
I feel like they've always or nearly always had these kind of elements in their music that has, and the imagery that has harkened back to a, you know, like Colin's kind of pursuit of simplicity and. And the personal again, you know, I'm trying to think if there's anything that kind of predates, I suppose, since he's working overtime, the verses in that have that, you know, and he said when he was writing that he was thinking of somebody working in a field. But I'm wondering if there's anything that in further back that kind of goes there. Maybe not.
Yeah, maybe this is the album where that they're being them more and more themselves, I suppose, that it's transitional in that sense.
There is a quote somewhere I saw that he was talking to a journalist at the time in 83, and he was saying that he didn't have a problem with people calling the record pastoral. Partridge is far from offended at hearing his new album described as pastoral. I take that as a compliment. When you live in this area, the real world happens to be 60 or 70% pastoral. You can't go anywhere 2 miles in Swindon without hitting downs or sheep. Pastoral to me means being much more in touch with the country than the city, which I think we are. So maybe it's just as simple as that. And it's just telegraphed somehow through their own music. You know, it's come out.
Yeah, I think that This Is Pop documentary was particularly good at getting that sense of the town and the country and both of them wielding influence equally, I think, on their music.
Well, actually, I also think that Play at Home is a must-see companion for Mama, because you really get the sense of Andy, especially, like, he's a born artist. You know, he can't stop himself, you know, which is a quality I really envy. He actually, it's like he can't turn it off. Mm. So if he's not writing songs, he's creating board games, or he's painting tin soldiers, or he's painting full stop. It's like his entire life is an artistic process. And it's this idea that you can come from a slightly nowhere town between Bristol and London, but be fully formed as a human being and as an artist, and present the fruits of your labor. And watching him do that, like that moment in Play at Home when he just decides to play us all a new song and proceeds to play Train Running Low on Soul Coal. It's just like, do you have to be so good? Like, really, do you have to? It's astonishing and beautiful. And I don't want to turn this into like a long thing, but one of my things about England specifically as it is at the moment, which is a country that is falling to pieces, is that we've completely lost the idea of localism. There used to be in the past things which different parts of this country were famous for. Different regions were famous for different things and would celebrate those things. And now we have all just been subsumed into one extremely boring whole. You know, it's like we don't have regional radio anymore. We don't have regional television anymore. You know, I have a friend who retired from working in radio a couple of years ago, and he was like, by the end, he was so frustrated because he just said, you know, what would happen is we'd have like a decent local radio station and then global media would buy it and turn it into Capital. Even though it was nowhere near London, and that's their kind of brand across the country. And it would have the same, you know, 30 records that everybody else was hearing. And then to fit in with Ofcom regulations, they would have like 1 hour a day of local, which would come from 90 miles away from where the station was supposed to be situated. And this idea of different places in the country having different influences and different kind of artistic output. And I'm sure it's still there to some extent, but because the infrastructure to support all that in terms of labels and in terms of distribution, in terms of income because of streaming, and in terms of places to play live, has all kind of gone away. There's less and less of that now than there ever was. And so it's quite heartening to watch Play at Home and see Andy in 1982, 83 in Swindon with his bandmates and their girlfriends and wives, and just being a fully formed artistic presence that's separate from the whole. You know, and I think that we could all do with more than that, because what's the point of art if it just reflects what we already know at us directly back? You know, if there isn't a tangent, if there isn't an angle, then it seems like something's been lost.
And it's also true to say, coming back to what Tim was saying about getting in on the coattails of Manchester, you know, the British music in particular has got a history of you know, a Glasgow sound or a Leeds sound or a Sheffield sound, and those bands emerging with some sort of shared collective identity.
Some of those bands are defined by their resistance to doing that thing that a lot of bands do, of moving to London. You know, they're like the Manchester Factory Records thing. You know, they were very, very anti-London. Perhaps Andy, you know, none of them ever moved out of Swindon, right? I'm right in saying that, but I mean, perhaps they couldn't. Perhaps Andy didn't feel like he could, and perhaps he felt there was some sort of pressure for him to be somewhere else, be in London, be in the middle of stuff when English settlement was happening and things were beginning to get quite successful, comparatively so, of course, and more well known. And maybe that was part of the pull. You know, he thought I need to be here because I'm drawing songs from the ground, you know, in Swindon, and as was Colin. And if they had moved to London, it might have completely screwed them up, you know.
Better to be big fish in a small pond.
Yeah.
Same reason the Human League never moved out of Sheffield.
Yeah. Well, there was a very supportive local network because, you know, I first started as a teenager, and in the early 80s, I mean, it's unbelievable to think of this now, that local radio stations, Piccadilly Radio, BBC Manchester, also the Liverpool equivalents, would actually play my demo tapes as an unsigned teenager. I used to get reviewed in the Manchester Evening News, so it'd be a sort of my shitty cassette demo next to the New Order and Kate Bush single. But it was so encouraging. You know, I remember we did our first demo, and we were on the front cover of our local newspaper. It's like, band produces demo, as if this is it, you know, great news story. But what was sort of interesting is there were fewer radio stations. So, you know, basically we had Piccadilly, we maybe had XFM in Manchester as well, and you had BBC GMR. But that was it. And from 6 o'clock onwards, you had people like Mark Radcliffe, who basically could play whatever they liked. Mm. And so you would have some of the new singles from the cutting edge artists, you know, at the time that might have been New Order, that might have then also been the new big single from Kate Bush. Then they play the demo by my teenage band or some other band. And it was incredibly eclectic. It was very much defined. Again, it was this curator. The DJ was the enthusiastic curator. But what was interesting is fewer stations, yet far more styles of music. You know, now if you go back to Manchester, you've got Piccadilly Gold, Piccadilly Jazz, Piccadilly Smooth, and actually they're playing a very similar pool of music, Piccadilly 80s. And it's a remarkably streamlined, limited amount of music on, let's say, 40 radio stations. You're probably getting fewer genres, fewer artists played than you did on three stations in Manchester in the 80s. And this is one of the reasons perhaps why you don't have that local identity, that local attachment. But also, you know, globally, I think there isn't that anymore. You know, you think of music TV in the 80s, The Tube, or Go Whistle Test. It could go from Adam and the Ants to Grandmaster Flash to King Crimson to Scott Walker. And I discovered a lot of my favourite artists through mainstream music television, going back to Magpie, you know, Godley and Cream and XTC, these mainstream kids shows that had remarkably unusual and eclectic music programming. And it's interesting now, you know, I can still get in my local newspaper that once had me on the front cover, but you know, I'll be that little eighth bit, but it will be taking the lead from the national media in terms of what they should cover musically, which is bizarre. You know, Manchester Evening News, Warrington Guardian should in effect musically be encouraging local artists for a local audience, giving them that first step up. And there doesn't seem to be that. And obviously, you know, XTC probably did have a real sense of grounding in Swindon. And I think that, yes, there was something very strong about their local identity in the work, which again, you know, perhaps goes back to that conversation we were saying, that there was something slightly archaic and old-fashioned, and maybe it was coming from this rural small town in the middle of Wiltshire, which I live relatively near now, so you know, no, I'm sort of an hour. I'm in Wiltshire, but an hour away from Swindon. But there was a real sense of community and locality, but also a real encouragement. You know, not as much media, but the media, I don't know, just seemed far more open than it does. It does seem to be programmed from a central source now.
Should we just maybe finish with a couple of any final thoughts about Mumma or Crawford? I think you did say that Lady Bird was your favourite song.
I think Lady Bird is my favourite song. It's exquisite. When I look at Mumma, I look at the cover in the greens and golds, and I think of the weather. I think of elemental things, earth and air, fire. It has a peaceful effect on my brain when I listen to it. And I there's not many records that bring peace to you, I feel. And I can go back to it and it's like a balm. Andy once talked about Yellow Submarine, the film. He called it Lemsip for the soul. And to me, Mumma is Lemsip for the soul.
Sean, you've previously declared a love on A Farm Boy's Wages. Is that the one that you would go for?
I would, but it was funny when I was listening to it this morning. Like, I love Love on a Farm Boy's Wages. I'm never going to tire of it. But I was listening to Me in the Wind and just thinking what an extraordinary piece of songwriting it is. Mm. And that this supposedly pastoral record has got this weird Michael Nyman-esque thing with his bizarre verse vocal harking back to the early days of XTC, sort of jammed in towards the end of this collection. And it's just gorgeous, you know? And I think as well, it's got three of Colin's best ever songs.
Mm. Yeah, yeah.
You know, I think Colin has a great showing on this record.
Mm. Yeah.
And it just feels like it's 10 tracks. The representations of both songwriters are excellent. It sounds gorgeous. It's beautifully arranged, beautifully performed. Pete Phipps's drums are absolutely fantastic. You know, it's got everything. So, yes, I could probably, if I were to make my ideal XTC album, I could probably pick like 10 tracks from across their career and say this is the greatest of XTC. But that's not a proper album, you know? So I would still stand up with this and say, I can put this on anytime you like, and I will listen to all 10 tracks and I will enjoy every single one of them for different reasons and come away like feeling enriched by the process, you know? And to be able to get that from any record is really important. And the fact that I can get it from a couple of different XTC records is even better, but it's this is the one for me.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Talking about Me and the Wind, it's one of those classic XTC songs that it actually sounds like it's written on the wind as well as, you know, it's performed by the wind. Everything, you know, the wind is just integral to it as well as it's the subject of it.
Well, what Crawford said about this being a really elemental record, and of course that had never really occurred to me until he just said it, and it's like, of course it is. Mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm. not just because there's a song called Deliver Us From the Elements, but, you know, and Great Fire and Me and the Wind, but the whole thing feels like it's been buffeted by the seasons in some
way. It feels like it's been left out in a field for a year and a half and then retrieved. and it's just beaten enough by the weather, just enough, you know, that kind of like all the sounds are a little bit kind of, yeah, desiccated.
Yeah. Anything to add to that, Tim?
Well, not really. I mean, my favourite track is probably Love and a Farm Boy's Wages, but then I love Deliver Us From the Elements, like, you know, tremendous power. And In Loving Memory of a Name, actually, I think is one of those songs that kind of gets lost, but it's really beautiful. And I think, you know, when you mention Me and the Wind, you suddenly think, oh, yeah, that is great. You know, it's, and this is the interesting thing, I suppose, with the album, that whenever you mention the title, and as I say, you know, I don't have an objection to funk, pop, or roll. I actually like that, and I totally agree with the idea that it sort of is a palate cleanser on the album, but it also prepares you for the following album, The Big Express. And that brilliant cover, which I remember as well, you know, finding in my local Hour price and being delighted with, you know. And seeing that, and of course, the Channel 4 documentary that then caused the No Man's Swap argument.
And I think it's really poetic as well that the first thing you hear on the album is Terry. I did love that.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And actually, quite a seamless division between, we haven't talked about the drumming too much, have we? But a seamless division between the two songs that Terry plays on and the others that Pete Phipps plays on. I don't think it doesn't feel jarring in that sense.
No, Human Alchemy has that kind of upside down reggae thing that Terry would do, you know, so beautifully. And...
Mm-hmm. Well, those are all the correct answers. Thank you very much. You are all officially indoctrinated into the Mummerista clan. So thank you very much, Crawford Blair, Tim Bonus, Sean McGee. I've been Mark Fisher. This has been What You Call That Noise, an XTC podcast. We will see you again next month. Thank you.
What do you call that noise?
Thank you again, Crawford Blair, Sean McGee and Tim Bowness, and to songwriter Chris Badley. And you can order the re-released Mama by XTC and Butterfly Mind by Tim Bowness at burningshed.com. Many, many thanks to the podcaster supporters on Patreon who make it all possible, including the following Knights and Shining Karma: Terry Arnott, Kevin Burt, Liam Duggan, Jamie Dunn, Leslie Gooch, Robert Graham, Alan Hughes, Marek Krauss, Jesper Kumberg, Robert Lawlor, Dennis LeCourier, Liz Lynch, Ian Morris, Youssef Murrah, Amy Parkinson, Murray Meikle, Karen Neal, Doug Perry, Mark Reed, James Reimer, Simon Slatholm, Michael Sutcliffe, Mark Thomas, and Nigel Waller. If you'd like to support the XTC podcast, and of course you'd like to support the XTC podcast, you can do so at patreon.com/Mark Fisher. We'll be back again next month. See you then.